Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And also me, Ian Morris.
And as ever, week to week, brought to you, all of you, by you. Thank you so much to our patrons supporting us each week at patreon.com/UK Tech and leaving us great reviews, mostly on iTunes. If you are a patron, this is your extended cut of this week's show, of course. And if you're not yet a patron but would like to have a try out of our extended cuts and our weekly columns and our as live unedited versions, head to patreon.com/UK Tech where you can find out how to support us with no commitments expected, no contracts, nothing like that. Thank you very much to several new patrons we've had since last week's episode: Leslie Longhurst, Phil Conybeare, Dave Seath, Ricky Wakefield, Giles King, Steve Prigg. You guys are amazing. We love you. I love you personally on a very deep level. Thank you very much for helping support us, keeping us motivated, and soon paying for a new microphone for Ian, which he's dearly excited about.
Which I don't need.
Now, before we progress any further with the show, there's something I wanted to address.
He's going to address the elephant in the room.
There is an elephant in the room, which is challenging in a small soundproofed room in your house. But there is an elephant in this room, and I was very upset this week, very cross. And it concerns a review that we had on iTunes. Now, I should make something a little bit clear. When you've been a journalist in mainstream media for a decade or longer, you get very used to people telling you you're wrong, telling you you should be fired, you should throw yourself off a building because of your opinions, all of which I've had. Ian has had many. Ian gets them weekly.
Someone told you to throw yourself off a building?
Somebody didn't like that I said Opera should give up making desktop browsers and focus on mobile.
They absolutely should give up desktop browsers. It's a hateful product. Anyway,
I said that in 2007. Someone says I should kill myself for that opinion. Prove them wrong on both counts, didn't I? I still believe that.
Yes. And I mean, really, if there's one thing you're going to do online, it shouldn't be to tell people to kill themselves. There's few things lower than that. Anyway, carry on.
However, this week, I did notice a review on iTunes, and I wanted to address a falsehood contained within, just in case anybody is under a false impression about what we're doing with Patreon and by having two versions of our show. The review, which was a one-star review, written by somebody
which
called...
we can live with, to be fair. Like, if people genuinely don't like the show, then it's only reasonable that they're able to give it a rating that reflects that. But as you'll get on to, it has to be a genuine thing, right?
Lots of people don't like other people's stuff, and that's fine. Bad reviews are fine. You know, bad reviews in a way help you find, sort of notice things that maybe the people who really like you don't bother pointing out. So they can be really helpful, and we're grateful for all reviews. It helps us refine the show. However, this one is misleading and very upsetting, actually. Written by somebody called Wagon Wheel, and the review, the one-line review is this: sad that this used to be a free podcast. Now you are expected to pay to hear the full version. Disappointed. Sad face. Emoji. Now, I have to address this in case anybody listening believes that something has changed fundamentally here. So the reason why this upset me so much: number one, this did not used to be a free podcast. It is still a free podcast. Thousands of people listen to the show for free, and those thousands of people we adore. And frankly, if we didn't have the people listening for free and only had people paying, I would consider that a failure on our part, because it's those people who are leaving reviews, who are telling their friends, who are sampling us and potentially starting listening to us for the first time. That's what keeps the interest in the wider market going on mass. Secondly, it didn't used to be a free podcast, because it still is. We didn't stop doing that.
I think that was your first point.
That was my first point, but I have to continue on that. You know, the show the show is still, the free show is still the same length it always used to be. The way that it works is that rather than recording the same amount of stuff we used to and then cutting stuff out and giving the free feed a shortened, trimmed version, we still give them exactly the same length version with the same stuff. It's just that we spend more time recording a longer version for the patrons, for the people who want it, who have given us feedback to say, these are the things that we like about the show, and so what we do is we do more of that. We review more sources for stories in the week. We record for a longer period of time in order to curate a bigger list of stories to then whittle down into those two versions. So it's you know, and then the third point I have to highlight is expected to pay. If anybody is under the impression that we think everyone should be paying for the show, you are wrong. It is just not. We like the people who choose to pay for some more because it does help us. It does support us. You know, we are... There has to come a point where something
ultimately
has to...
it keeps ads out of the programme, right? It means that people don't have to sit through a tedious mention of a product they might or might not be interested in, but having it, you know... Because those adverts are bothersome. And yes. almost always get skipped, and that means you end up sort of maybe skipping part of the show. And adverts are we certainly had offers, didn't we? And for relatively good amounts of money, but it's not something either of us really want to do. As professional writers,
No. We
are largely sick and tired of being monetized against with adverts.
Yes, that is exactly 100% right. The reason I set the goals and the targets for Patreon the level I did is I used as a benchmark the amount of money we were offered to include ads into the show that I turned down. To say, right, well, that's how much money every month I'm turning away by not having ads. So that's how much I would like the Patreon to be able to do. Which, by the way, you've hit. And that is now what the show makes. And that's why we still don't have ads. It's why we can afford to do a free version that involves editing two separate versions of the show every single week. You know, it's 15 hours of my week every single week. And probably two-thirds of that is on a Sunday. That's why we're doing it this way. But I really wanted to just get this across to anyone listening to free that they think that if we're taking anything away or we don't value you or anything like that, it simply isn't true. You know,
I think as well, when you're listening to the free podcast, it's always going to feel a little bit like that if we go on about how great it is over on the Patreon podcast and how much better it is. But we don't do that. It isn't like that, is it? We offer extra value to the Patreon people because that's just the way the whole operation is set up.
Exactly.
But really, ultimately, you're getting most of it for free on the free podcast. It's just it's a slightly different product. And like you said, we have no desire to stop a podcast that's popular and successful because, you know, ultimately, money pays our mortgages, but our egos are stoked by listener numbers.
Yes, and they're the people that leave reviews and that tell their friends and say, hey, I've just discovered this new podcast you might
like. Yeah, and the people who we know, obviously we don't know who of our friends listen, or the people that know us, or professionals working in our industry who we deal with on a daily basis. But sometimes they say something. Like I had a friend of ours who mentioned to me about, you know, what he liked about the podcast and, you know, why he thought it was good, and that's really nice. And it's good to sort of it's those things that make us keen to carry on. They're what energise us day to day, and the money is something that was designed to help keep the thing going and also to improve it, because like we said, you know, our plan for the money wasn't just about obviously it's not largely me, it's Nate's project and he spends all his time on it, but we were also talking about going places and doing things and that all has an expense attached to it. And
it
we
does
can't do that without, you know, at least someone being invested, and we'd rather it was owned by the listeners than
it's true.
What's it called? Wix. Is that all I see on YouTube videos is Wix. It's the website builder thing.
Yeah.
But it's like, why are you targeting me like this? I don't need a website builder. I've built my own website. It's fine.
Yeah, and if you guys would rather do it that way, then, you know, the feedback, it's always open. The reason we do it this way is it means that the small number of people that would really like more of what we do and behind-the-scenes stuff and unedited versions and all that kind of stuff, you know, you guys support us, but the it's supporting the free stuff as well. You know, it's everybody together. Everyone supports in their own way, and it means we can carry on doing it. And I don't mind admitting personally that another part of the reason is that, you know, we've been doing the show for 3 years. We're coming up to 100 episodes, and I needed to work out for myself, shall we carry on past episode 100? Or was episode 100 going to be the last one we did and go out on a big bang? And frankly, you know, doing the Patreon and having people email us and having good reviews and people tell us they like the show and things, like, frankly, that motivates you. That makes you think, yes, let's carry on. Let's see how it goes. Let's see if we can get to episode 150, episode 200, or you know, into the many hundreds, or, you know, what have you. And that's what it's all about. So I had to address it, you know, because it's wrong. And basically, I was worried that if one person says something, then maybe there are other people who didn't say something who think it. And so if you're listening on our free feed, thank you for being here. You are not expected to pay, and we take nothing away from you. The Patreon stuff, it is there as an option if you want to support us a bit further or if you want more of what we do, but you will never get any less. And I'll say it right here, right now, the show will never become shorter for free people. It will never become less regular for free people. So that's the situation.
Yeah.
I think I got through that.
We did. And we spent a lot of time talking about what we did and didn't want to do for the free and Patreon feeds, didn't we? It didn't like just happen. It was a quite considered approach. And we've back and forwarded on it quite a bit, haven't we? To try and I, you know, you've asked me questions about whether I think this or that would work. And I've given you what I think. So, you know, it's a considered approach. Anyway, that's enough of that, isn't it?
Yes. So either way, however you're listening, however you're supporting, whether that's just leaving us a nice review on an iTunes or similar, telling a colleague, telling a spouse, parents, sons and daughters, whatever way you're supporting, it all matters. And everybody who's listening, we're incredibly grateful. So thank you. And hopefully, if the person who did leave that review is still listening, which I strongly doubt, you know, hopefully this has at least allowed us a reply that, sadly, iTunes does not let us do. So, there we go. Ian, shall we get into some news now?
That sounds like a great idea.
Right, let's do that. A consortium, love that word, of British companies has unveiled a plan to test driverless cars on UK roads and motorways in 2019, according to the BBC, which reported on this week. The BBC said that the Driven Group also plans to try out a fleet of autonomous vehicles driving between London and Oxford. Now, these cars are going to communicate with each other about hazards and anything that may affect their driving experience, if you like, or the ease of driving. And it will operate with almost full autonomy. It will have a human on board as well. And most of these trials do tend to still involve humans, just in case something goes wrong. And the reason this is particularly interesting is that tests of driverless vehicles in the UK have generally taken place very slowly, as in at slow speeds, and they've not been on public roads. They've been in private areas where the environment can be controlled. This is going to be on motorways, which are generally fast and have minimum speed limits. Now, the BBC said that this consortium Driven is led by a group called Oxbotica, which makes software for driverless vehicles. And it quoted founder Professor Paul Newman of the University of Oxford saying, "We're moving from the singleton autonomous vehicle to fleets of autonomous vehicles. And what's interesting is what data the vehicles share with one another, when and why." And the government's put a few million quid behind this project. So I think this is a really interesting idea. I think we'll see when this does start in just over a year and a half, maybe a couple of years' time, we'll start seeing reports on social media to begin with as, "Ooh, saw this driverless car and the car was driving and the guy's hands weren't on the wheel." And I think there's a potential, therefore, for this to be quite exciting for us. You know, it's like spotting one of the Google Street View cars and trying to get in the picture or something, which happened to me a few months ago, which was quite fun.
No, did you get in the picture?
I have no idea. I forgot to check until now. but also, of course, the risks here is that if there is an accident, the scrutiny, particularly from, you know, the more conservative media outlets in the country, you know, will jump on it as terror strikes and British motorways is ridiculous. Company A thinks it's fine to do this, blah, 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 blah. I think it's a great step because we're a little bit behind in testing some of this stuff because a lot of the big companies doing this thing, these sorts of things are in the US. So I think there are some in Asia, of course, too. Ian,
yeah.
Thoughts, my friend?
Well, yeah, I mean, I I think the one of the most exciting bits of things about the self-driving cars will be their ability to communicate with each other, because it, ultimately, if a car knows it's going to have to brake, then communicating that with the cars further down the road could mean that you'd have much more like a the goal would be to have like a train where the lead car pulls away and all of the subsequent cars pull away at the exact same speed, and that means you can clear a traffic light with a lot more precision and speed. Although I guess the long-term goal is to get rid of every kind of traffic management system entirely. When all cars are able to talk to one another, you'll be able to have no traffic lights, and crossings will just be managed by the cars talking to each other, which would be, you know, amazing. But that's, you know, maybe 100 years away. Perhaps, I don't know, maybe not 100 years. But I think by this time in 100 years, we'll definitely have got rid of humans driving cars. There will be no point. There'll be, you know, hyperloops everywhere or something like that.
We've largely got rid of them driving planes already.
Well, you know. Yes, I mean, that's true. And, you know, and computers are generally better at things like that. You know, with a few small examples, a few small exceptions of things, you know, if you only have to look at the car itself, mostly it's not mechanics that let cars down, you know, I mean, the engineering and stuff like that. It's the human behind the wheel. So as soon as we get rid of all those people doing that dangerous thing, it'll be better. I mean, I am split because I like cars. And I don't know what the world will look like when there's no cars that are, you know, when they're just objects of conveyance. What will happen when there's no supercars?
Yes. Well, quite. We'll have to keep our eye on it, I suppose, won't we?
Well, we will. It'll happen sooner or later.
Podcast@natelangson.com. Do let us know your thoughts on this, for or against. Now, there was an interesting write-up on Engadget this week, Ian, this week. It showed that book sales in the UK are on the rise. However, not because of e-books, thank you very much. That's because figures for 2016 were released by a group called the Publishers Association, writes Engadget, and it showed within those figures that there was a 7% rise over 2015 for 2016 in the sale of physical books. And that's the largest year-over-year growth in a decade. Physical sale books were up 8% apparently in, I don't know why that figure is different in my write-up, but about 7 or 8%. But ebooks themselves fell 3%. Now, the blame on this has been placed on what are called consumer ebooks. That's your fiction stuff and biographies. And they slipped 17% in 2016 versus 2015. And it's been suggested in part that maybe we spend so much time on our smartphones and our laptops and iPads and things that for many, reading a printed book is actually an opportunity to disconnect. And so the printed book there does win. It may also be why this is the second year in a row that consumer ebook sales have dropped. There are, I think, personally, some other factors at play here. Maybe fewer good books were released that people actually wanted to buy, or that maybe, and I saw this on a separate write-up, part of the reason is that some of the really big books were ones like the new Harry Potter book, where a lot of people wanted to buy those as gifts, and people prefer to give a printed book as a gift than an ebook, because you can wrap one of them versus the other. Yeah. So, you know, that's not to say that it's a tiny market. I mean, it's still over £200 million a year just in these ebooks. So it's still a big deal. But at the moment, at least, it seems that the old printed page is seeing a little bit of a comeback, a bit of a strong player. Ian, do you read many printed books? Do you prefer ebooks?
It's interesting. I'll be honest. Most of the reading I do is on my computer, and it's not. Because of where we are in the world at the moment, I'm mostly concerned with current affairs, and I don't read a huge amount of fiction particularly. The book I'm reading at the moment on my Kindle is Glenn Greenwald Snowden book.
Nowhere to Hide?
Good book. But again, that's all tied into current affairs. I basically find that I'm mostly consumed by that at the moment. So I don't know. I haven't picked up a fiction book for ages. I've got to say, I like physical books, but I like the Kindle almost as much. But I would say I like reading a book. I don't know why. I do find it a little bit more of a struggle on a Kindle.
I'm somewhere in a different category to this because we're talking here about ebooks, but I'm a massive fan of the audiobook, you know, which may come as very little surprise to people, what with the whole podcasting thing. But I mean, I used to read far less fiction than I do now, and like you, I like a lot of sort of current affairs things. But I mean, I read an awful lot of books about North Korea and have done for many years, and Japanese history and a lot of stuff like that. And I do tend to prefer the physical book for those, for the reasons that some have posited online, that it's a chance to escape. It's going to a coffee shop, putting your phone away, and just focusing on that book. And I like that. And I can't remember the last time I read an ebook, you know, certainly not one that I paid for. So, you know, that's a different thing.
Here's what I do like about ebooks, of course, is the fact that I can decide to buy one and buy it now and have it that second.
True. The thing is, though, with things like Amazon Prime, if you are buying from Amazon for books, it does arrive very, very quickly. And they do have some deals where if you buy a book from them, you get the first couple of chapters available on Kindle. So you can read that while you wait for it to post. They've done that for years with music as well. You buy a CD and you get an MP3 version in your Amazon library straight away to listen to. So it serves both issues. Well, let us know how you currently divide your time between ebooks or maybe audio books or printed books. Do you have a preference? Have your habits changed? You know, that would be a really interesting thing to hear about. If you used to read a lot of printed books, but actually now you prefer ebooks, or vice versa. We'd love to hear some examples, either on Twitter at TextMessagePod. You can tweet us your thoughts there, or email us directly, podcast@natelangson.com. We'd love to hear some thoughts on this for next week's show. Well, Ian, something happened this week, or something I read about this week, tied into a column I wrote this week for our patrons about adverts and creepy adverts and privacy. And the story is that this month, Channel 4 in the UK is bringing a new ad format to its on-demand platform, which targets the viewer in a much more direct way, specifically including their name as part of the promotion. Which you can do, because if you're registered for On Demand...
Which you have to be,
then it knows your name, or certainly knows the name that you input. A few advertisers have signed on already on behalf of 20th Century Fox. Aren't they 21st Century Fox now?
They are.
Okay, well, they've signed up, whichever name. Foster's, the beer people, Ron Seal. They're among the first that I saw written about this week, at least. And users will be able to opt out of seeing them if they find them intrusive or creepy, which I most certainly would. Ian, before I carry on, I'm curious what you think to these types of ads in general.
I hate everything about this. Really.
I thought that might be the case.
I mean, I understand what they're trying to do. They're trying to get engagement in a world where it's quite difficult to get engagement. But I just think it says everything. Right, the whole registration thing was annoying at the start when they said, right, you're going to have to register now. It used to be that you could watch for free, but the extra features would only be added for people who registered. For example, building up a profile of shows that you wanted to watch, or letting it suggest to you things that you would probably enjoy. But mostly allowing people to still see programs without it. And then, you know, they said, oh, we're going to make people register. And everyone's like, okay, but I mean, is this not going to be like, you know, just an ad sales thing? And then sure enough, along comes this idea, and I don't like it. I do not like it at all.
I imagine that might be the case. It is very much creepy. Now, I wrote about this in this week's column, which goes out to some of our patrons. I do a column once a week over there about something that's intrigued me or this week disturbed me in the news. And part of this was because there were two occasions, one where I saw a hyper-personalised ad from a company called Trainline.com, where I'd looked up some train times, didn't buy the tickets because I was just looking at the information, and then the next day, on a completely unrelated website when I was reading the news, an ad popped up suggesting I complete the journey to the town in question that I was going to, and I just found that to be incredibly creepy. And then on Instagram, which I don't use very often, but I do check in once a week, I'd left a comment on somebody's picture. They were in a town that is very, very close to where I'm getting married in October, and I left a comment along those lines about my wedding. And I'm convinced, I'm 99% convinced that I only started seeing ads about wedding paraphernalia after I posted that comment on several occasions, whereas I never noticed them before. And I thought both of these things, I don't know, they just, they creeped me out. They made me feel bad towards Trainline because I was like, no, naughty. That does not make me feel good. It makes me feel bad about the brand. So I wrote that in the column. And this example that Channel 4 is doing is, again, another example there. And I know this is where ads are going. You know, personalization is key. Maybe this has great conversion rates. Maybe that's why everyone wants to do it, because it catches your eye. And that's good for advertisers. But I do think that people are so aware of it now that there will be a pushback. So I'm curious, obviously, about other people's views on this. But it's going to start this month, I believe. If anyone's seen one of these already, I haven't personally seen one because I don't use Channel 4's service. But if you have seen one and you've had one of these ads, I would love to hear about that and how that made you feel. Wouldn't you, Ian?
Yeah, I would. And I mean, we see this. You can always tell when something's a bad idea, can't you? When it crops up in fiction as kind of like, oh, watch out, guys. This could happen one day. And I remember, I think, is it Minority Report or iRobot or something?
And there are
personalized ads, aren't there, on the street? And you see it a lot in science fiction. And, you know, it's just alarming, really. And it means that they've got access to something about you. I mean, it may only be your name this time, but once they've done that, then they'll be like, oh, what else can we use? And it's a creep, isn't it? And it'll become from name, it'll be to gender, and then it'll be, you know, something you bought recently. Oh, we saw you bought our competitor's product. I bet you're not happy with it. Why don't you buy our product?
Yeah, which is always silly when you're followed around to being advertised things that you've just bought, which happened a lot when we bought our house. Houses, but coffee tables constantly. I couldn't get could not get away from coffee tables. Like, there was no box to say, I've already bought one. Sod off. Yeah. Which would have been a lovely option.
And I got, you know, when I look for something, I will almost certainly see adverts constantly for it. But a lot of the time I might be doing some research, so it might not be a product I'm actually interested in. And I guess for them, it's just a matter of mopping up those people who were undecided and who would still like to buy one. But 99% of the time, I just think, well, that's wasted money, isn't it? Or if I've already bought it, I'm like, well, this is absolutely wasted money because I've already bought the thing.
Yeah. Well, we had a good response from one of our patrons, Mike. Hello, Mike, via email, in response to the column that I'd written, who said, I clean my history and cookies on my browser after each use. I use a VPN. I primarily do my shopping on Amazon using my Kindle Fire. Thus far, I've never seen a hyper-targeted ad like the ones you mentioned. I get recommendations via email from eBay, but they are way off base. Only the ads on my Kindle are more relevant. What I see on my browser, Chrome, are pretty random. My guess is that I'm pretty hard to target.
I like that.
Yeah, I agree too. I think if you can make yourself really difficult to target, then you can have some fun with the advertisers.
Or just totally spoil their data by having a bot search on your connection for everything that you could possibly imagine.
Or for a laugh, put that bot on someone else's machine and generate some very odd ads for them.
Only for a very specific kind of, I don't know, elbow cream.
Yes.
Elbuleave.
Ian, you were excited about something this week. The Galaxy S8, which was released relatively recently. You've been sent one.
The S8, the Galaxy S8 even, is a much anticipated phone, I guess, isn't it? And I've managed to get my hands on one, which is good. And I've got to say, I am feeling very happy about this phone. It has given me enormous pleasure. I won't proclaim a full sort of verdict on it yet because I have only been using it for a few days. But in terms of looking at this phone, you think, goodness gracious me, this company has come on so far. There are not very many pieces of industrial design, I think, that can show Apple how it's done. But I would say that the S8 is exactly that. I'm going to pick it up. Hold on.
This will work well on audio listeners.
Well, yeah, because I feel like I should be holding it whilst I talk.
Yes, touch and tell.
The manufacturing process for this is very slightly different to how it's done with Apple. Obviously, this is two pieces of glass that are sort of bonded around a central piece of metal. Mm-hmm. And indeed, you can. There's been a very nice hack I've seen online where someone has removed the back cover, stripped the paint off, and is then left with a clear back, which is actually a really, really nice idea. I think Samsung should pursue that as an idea, as an option. Mm-hmm. But the build quality of this thing is really very nice. It's tall and thin, which means you can reach your thumb almost across the whole thing with relative ease. I've got to say, the one thing that I believe about the S8 now is that it's Samsung has almost sort of invalidated the point of having the Plus. It's not like Apple, where the Plus is given an extra feature, which is almost critical. Like the camera on the Plus, I just wouldn't want to live without it. I just think that camera is so good.
Is that the main phone you use, the iPhone 7 Plus?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, day to day. And the camera is a big part of that. It is not the best camera in the world on the iPhone 7. I think that I've said this a few times before. I think they made a bit of a misstep because they increased the resolution, and that's had an impact on the low light sensitivity. And I feel like phones like the Google Pixel, the S8, which uses similar technology, have sort of leapfrogged ahead very slightly. And low light doesn't sound like a massive deal, perhaps, to a lot of people. But it influences the quality of every picture you take to some degree.
And the Pixel, I have to say, is the best low light camera I've personally used.
It's really good. And I haven't fully tested the S8 yet to see how well it compares to the Pixel. But the Pixel has got it nailed.
Tell me a bit more about then what's made you so excited about this. Because at the end of the day, when I hear people, really going overboard about how much they love the new iPhone and how much they love the new Galaxy, I think, well, what were you expecting? Were you expecting to hear, oh, it's very average? You know, it's always huge excitement. And I sort of think, well, why are you surprised? Like, what's so overwhelming that it beat even your, meager expectations up front?
Well, I wouldn't say it's about meager expectations particularly. I just feel like, I suppose I'm a little bit easier on these companies than maybe some people are. I understand that technology progresses at a certain rate, and that there comes a point in any product where it's a struggle to add new features. There's only so much you can do, and each iterative update is largely a few small tweaks, which is why if I was buying my own phone, I don't think I'd be too bothered about jumping, say. I would have wanted the iPhone 7, but I probably, I could have lived with the... I would definitely say I would never have upgraded to the Galaxy S7 over the S6, because I have an S6 Edge and I love that phone. I think it's the perfect ratio of size, design and features, and it's still going strong now, and that's now 2 years old, right? So for me, that phone was sort of like... It was the phone where they changed it just enough, added all the right features, and it just works really well.
So tell me another thing about the S8 then that makes it so spectacular.
Well,
in your limited testing so far.
In my limited testing so far. I would say I'm finding the camera extremely nice. I'm really enjoying the camera.
Would you swap it for an iPhone? The iPhone 7?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I think probably more testing would be needed. Okay. I suspect it's better. My gut would say that it's probably a better performer. Again, there are some differences, like that Samsung processes images. I think you always get a more natural picture with the iPhone. Mm. And I like natural pictures. Like, that's my thing. I like a picture to not be too blown out in its color.
Yes, I have to say, I mean, I've got a Pixel as well and an iPhone 7 Plus. And they both have HDR modes, high dynamic range photography modes, which do create a better picture in many environments. I find the HDR mode on the iPhone is a little more subtle than the one that's on the Google Pixel. Like in the Pixel one, you can instantly tell it's HDR. On the iPhone one, you can tell it's different and it looks clear, but it might not be super immediate that it's had some processing applied to it.
I think it needs to be something that just lifts a few details from areas that would be normally overexposed.
Yeah.
And that's enough to really cheer up a photo. And actually, you're right. I recently had cause to look at what the iPhone was doing with HDR photos, and actually it's really good. Like, it really makes a huge difference.
Tell me something. I want to know something.
Well, I was taking some pictures outside.
No, I had a specific thing in mind. Tell me. I mean, go ahead.
Oh, right. I thought you were going to just ask me about what it was I'd seen that had made me think, oh, that's really good.
No. I mean, go ahead.
Well, go on. Ask me the question.
It's not about cameras.
Oh.
Yeah.
What is it about?
Here's what it's about. I'm curious as to whether, if a listener is listening, which most listeners are by nature, if they have let's say they've got an S7 and they've got an iPhone, or they've got, not a 7, iPhone 7, an iPhone 6 or a 6S.
Yeah.
Based on what you've used of this S8 so far, would you say it is worth an upgrade to this?
Oh, right. So to switch from an older iPhone to a newer Galaxy.
Or the previous Samsung. Let's say the 6 or the 7, but probably more the 7, to this one. Would you, let's say they're being offered an upgrade, but it involves tying into a new contract.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, all upgrades involve being tied into a new contract. I would apply my usual logic. I would say don't ever break a contract, or, you know, get tied up in, you know, trying to sell a phone. And it's all nonsense, right? So, yes, the phone is physically the nicest phone they've ever made. It's beautifully made. I like the new ratio. It's great. The screen is superb. But no, I don't ever think people should be rushing to upgrade. I think you've got to be clever with your money. Like, if you're a millionaire, fine, do what you want. But I'll bet you money no millionaire has got that way by being stupid with cash.
No.
So, you know, wait. There's never a reason to really... And we see all of these new phones, don't we, right? And I'm always thrilled to get my hands on a new phone. And there's always bits and pieces about it that I really like. So I think Samsung's nailed a load of stuff. For example, the look of it now... It has non-physical buttons, and the top bar, as with a lot of Androids for some time now, is now transparent so that you see the background through the thing. It gives this phone it's slick. It's really slick, and it's slick in a way that I don't think Apple's quite got yet. And a lot of the rumours we're seeing around the iPhone 8 suggest that it's things like this, you know, giving it a sort of contiguous look. With buttons overlaid on the screen rather than physical keys is something that I think adds something to the look of a phone.
Yeah, but and that will be very interesting as well this year, because it is the 10th anniversary of the iPhone, and it's expected Apple's going to do some big wow factor, you know, high-end release for that. But at the same time, the upgrade cycle for Apple's phones is very predictable. They go, you know, iPhone 4, iPhone 4S, iPhone 5, iPhone 5S, iPhone 6, iPhone 6S, iPhone 7. We're now ready for an iPhone 7S, which is normally incremental. You know, often software-based updates, modest updates to technology, not groundbreaking overhauls of industrial design, which is what maybe the anniversary edition will be instead. But I think the challenge will be on Apple to create something that can compete with this, if that's the way that consumer sentiment is pointing in terms of being a desirable thing.
There will be a high-priced option, won't there, for the iPhone that will be probably out of the reach of a lot of people, but will be an anniversary celebration of the phone. It just comes back to what's physically possible. That, you know, we cannot leapfrog physics, can we? And a lot of them are really struggling at the moment to get this hidden fingerprint scanner tech working, where you embed it beneath the screen. And it's obviously not working en masse, which is a problem, which is what Samsung wanted to do. They have placed it at the back. It is a pain in the bottom. And I have to say that I didn't think I was going to be put off by its location. But in fact, I have been. It's incredibly inconvenient.
Tell me about the headphones. I want to know about the headphones.
You want to know about the headphones.
You talked about the bundled headphones, which in most products are generally, you know, average at best, but basically chuck away and buy some better ones.
Yeah.
But you've been raving about these.
And I would say that you probably wouldn't be quite so enthusiastic, but they sound pretty good. They have a good range. They have some bass. It's not overwhelming. They have... not overblown treble, I would say. The mid-range is clear. They fit very comfortably. They're nice to wear in your ears. And there's a few other niceties about it as well. For example, they're made of a fabric. There's a fabric wrap around the majority of the cable, which means that they don't get tangled very easily. And I tangled them deliberately the other night, and they just come apart really easily. It's quite nice. Samsung said, I think, something like, oh, this is a $99 pair of headphones. And I strongly dispute that. I don't feel like this is a in that price range. I would say if you were going to go out and spend £30 on a pair of headphones, this is probably what you'd get.
Which is amazing, like, because you know, for the ones that come in the box for the iPhone, while they're not the worst out there, they are, you know, I mean, they just sit in a drawer. Like, they're worth a fiver.
For me, it's about a lot. I would say almost half of the experience with headphones is how they fit in my ears. For one thing, even a really good pair of really expensive headphones will not sound good if they aren't seated in your ear with the correct size grommet. And out of the box, these are comfortable. They fit well. They're light. And that, therefore, you get a little advantage in, you know, that the sound is transmitted well. You know, they're fundamentally included headphones. They're never going to be as good as a pair that you buy yourself. But for the people who almost certainly do what they do, which is get the phone, take the headphones out of the box, use the headphones until they break, they're a great pair of headphones.
Now, it reminds me...
They don't have Samsung written on them, which means they'll have a tiny amount more street cred as well.
Well, if you have opinions or questions about or for Ian, about Ian's views, I mean, you can ask Ian questions about himself. He probably won't answer you. about the S8 and his experiences so far, do send them in. podcast@natelangson.com. If you've bought one and received one already and want to tell us if you agree or disagree with anything Ian said, then again, send the points there or to @textmessagepod. I'll probably get one in at some point and have a play, largely just so I can disagree with Ian for a laugh.
We'll do that
on a future episode.
You're welcome to do so, but I think you'll struggle to find anything majorly wrong with it. It is very pleasant.
Well, challenge accepted, Chief. One very little quick news story I just wanted to chuck in here because it's so close to my heart. I saw this on the BBC. Apparently, an overuse of mobile phones by parents disrupts family life. This is according to a survey of secondary school pupils, as I said, as reported by the BBC. Now, about 2,000 11 to 18-year-olds were surveyed in this poll, and more than a third of them said they had asked their parents to stop checking their devices. Now, as a little side note before we go further, I find this incredibly hard to believe and probably assume this is a massive double standard, because if you've ever seen an 11 to 18 year old basically anywhere, phones are glued to them. I walk to a train station every morning, which may come as a very little surprise, and I always pass a lot of secondary school kids who are going to get their trains, usually in groups of, you know, 2, 3 or 4. They're all standing there with the phones out, with their earphones in, sort of talking to each other but largely paying attention to whatever's on their phone. And I think, fine, that's the way kids are, whatever. I do find it very surprising that 2/3 of the ones that I see have said to their parents, "Mum, tell you something, you use your phone too much." I just don't think it happens. I think it's a bit of double standards going on here. However,
Go on.
I will continue with the numbers. 14% of those surveys said that their parents were online at mealtimes. 14% say that. However, 95% of 3,000 parents who were polled separately said they do not use their phones at mealtimes. So somebody's telling Porkies. I suspect it's the parents because they're embarrassed to admit that they use their phone through dinner instead of talking to their children. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I'd do. If I was polled, I'd probably lie. And what else do we have here? 82% of kids polled felt that mealtimes should be device free, which is more interesting. That I think that almost 20% thinks it's fine to use their phone at mealtimes. Each to their own there. And then 22% of those polled, so nearly a quarter, said that the use of mobile phones stopped their families enjoying each other's company. Which I can believe. And I'm trying not to be judgmental here. As everyone knows, I'm very much a proponent for sort of switching off and not using phones through dinners and mealtimes and things. I just found these numbers very, very interesting. And I think there's a good balance. And I think that companionable silence is quite endearing. You know, if you're just sitting around, you know, playing on your iPads silently while something's on the telly, I think that can be really lovely too. But mealtimes and things are a little different. And I just found that these numbers were quite interesting. What do you think, Ian, as a parent?
What I would say, I sometimes get told that I'm on my phone too much, but I think that the kids learn it from parents, so I don't actually think kids care that much. They see it and they don't necessarily think it's unusual. But I've been, you know, Izzy said, "Oh, why are you on the app again?" or whatever like that, you know. And it's fine. I accept the fact that, you know, I look at my phone a fair bit. That's because I'm, you know, seeing what's going on with the world. I'm always thinking about, you know, stories and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, and fundamentally, I like you, I don't think there's really any reason to be checking your phone at mealtime. I have to admit, I come from having had a meal where I have been checking my phone, because obviously we discuss various aspects of the show ahead of recording it. So we
well, I'm an exception, you know, to the rule. It's always fine to be messaging me during mealtime, during when you're at the cinema, on the toilet, you know, during you know, adult congress, like all acceptable if it's to me about the show, because they're the levels we go to give people this kind of quality output.
Quality output.
What a great observation that was.
Very good. Absolutely awe-inspiring, of course.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, but people do use their phones a lot, and it's a sort of new problem, right? Because what can I say? You know, we didn't have phones when I was a kid, so it's very difficult to know how it would be.
Magazines, mate. It was magazines.
Yeah. Like, this is the thing, right? So, I mean, all of us probably have memories of our parents ignoring us while they were reading the paper. You know, or something like that. It isn't really any different. It's just a different thing.
Yeah, it is. Well, let us know your views on this. Obviously, you know, I mean, I may have offended some people, may have intrigued some people, and apologies, or you're welcome, depending on which side of that fence you fall on. Just some observations, but let us know any thoughts you have. podcast@nateslangston.com. Do you have any rules in your family about, you know, when acceptable phone time is or is not? We'd love to extend this into another episode if you have some feedback. podcast@nateslangston.com. And speaking of podcast@natelangson.com, we had a few emails this week. One, just wanted to note from Kyriakos, who did make a really interesting point about our conversation regarding contactless payments the last couple of weeks, which is if you go into TFL or start a train journey, you have to tap in at the beginning and you tap out at the end of your journey. And he highlighted that maybe an issue that sort of bubbling is the fact that you could have a debit card registered to a couple of different phones as well as the debit card itself. And should these stations maybe acknowledge the fact that instead of forcing you to use the same device, maybe it should be okay to, you know, to tap in with the debit card contactlessly on your iPhone, but tap out with the card itself and not be billed separately or things like that. I thought that was a really interesting point that we should keep our eye on. We also had an email from longtime listener Richard Gunther, who says, "Hi guys, you were asking if any of your listeners agreed with the assertion that Planet Earth 2 might encourage one to move to 4K. We did indeed. I think that was last week. Richard continues, "I've already made that move and I've purchased Planet Earth 2 on Ultra HD Blu-ray. Like you with audio, Nate, I still purchase video content on physical media so I can get the highest quality while keeping my viewing options open. I can tell you that the visuals, particularly with HDR enabled, are stunning. Like other HDR titles, the images are so realistic, they almost appear to have depth. This will likely become a reference disc set for many. And I remember reading some reviews on just on Amazon on the listing for UHD, where a few other home cinema enthusiasts say that this was a really great like reference picture quality that others should be compared against." Richard continues, "There's one area where this particular 4K title disappoints. Nearly every 4K title available today is packaged with standard Blu-ray equivalents and digital copy redemption codes for the same content. While you can find editions that include standard Blu-ray discs in the UK, that's not true of the version released in the US. And I haven't found any that include digital copy redemption. This looks great on my 4K TV, but I won't be able to watch this on anything else. So much for keeping my options open." Now, thank you very much, Richard. I think some really interesting points there. And I always love feedback about stuff where there's a really big difference between how something is in Britain for us and another country. And this is a great example of where it seems we get a slightly better deal on the Blu-ray stuff here. And as a side note, Richard does a great podcast. He didn't mention this. This is just because I happen to know it. He does a great podcast called Entertainment 2.0 at thedigitalmediazone.com, which if you do like observations like this about home theatre, I would give it a shout. And anyone who emails in, I'll be happy to plug anything you make too, because we do love your emails so very much. So thank you, Kyriakos and Richard and Mike earlier in the show, and everyone else who's got in touch this week. Podcast@natelangson.com. We look forward to hearing more for next week's show. But Meanwhile, I think it's time to check in with Tom Merritt and hear what's been going on over the last few days in the wider world of tech. Tom.
Hey, thanks, Nate. This week we talked about Twitter's spam bot problem and whether they're doing enough to combat it. Talked about Twitter's desire to become a 24/7 video channel, too. We discussed whether Google is in fact finally the new Microsoft, which people have been saying for years. Kicked around the rumor that Apple might get into competition with payment services like Venmo. Parents, ask your kids. And why don't Android phones get OS updates for more than 2 years? Maybe blame the chip makers. All that and more at DailyTechNewsShow.com. Back to you guys.
Thanks, Tom. Actually, their discussions in about Twitter's developments that he just mentioned, well worth hearing. I'm really curious about what Twitter's doing with video. And I think live, sort of 24/7 live video on Twitter is just so interesting. It's so far away from what they used to be. But at the same time, using Twitter alongside live TV feels like such a natural partnership. So do check that out. DailyTechNewsShow.com. That's it, Ian. We're done. A little bit of a longer episode, thanks to our introductory explanation about the Patreon and free shows. So you've got a longer bit of us this week, regardless of whether you're supporting us on patreon.com or supporting us simply by listening and telling your friends and family and leaving us reviews. However you're listening, you're all part of the family, and Ian and I love you dearly.
We sure do.
We treat you all as equals, except for the people who do support us financially, and they get a longer version. But we've gone over that. I think that'll do, Ian. I'm starving. I need some sausage.
You go and fill your face with sausage, mate.
I shall. Go and have an avocado.
I will do. Well, actually, I've had an avocado today. I don't need another one. Okay. I've got some guacamole for later, though.
That's interesting. Well, we'll come back to that on next week's episode of Things Nate and Ian Have Swallowed. Tumblr.com. Bye, everybody.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.